This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Chinese Americans are one of the fastest growing ethnic groups in America today. People from China began coming to the U.S. in large numbers in the 19th century. That was the first of three waves of Chinese immigration. The second began in the middle of the 20th century, the third in the 1980s. Today, the Chinese American population numbers more than 3 million. Throughout the history of the Chinese in America, Chinese Americans have been praised and celebrated, but they have also been vilified and persecuted. This afternoon, a conversation about the hardships and successes of the Chinese in America. Our guest is historian Iris Chang. She is the author of the new book, The Chinese in America, A Narrative History. In the introduction to The Chinese in America, Chang says the book tells two stories. One, the push-pull story of Chinese emigration. How did emigres make the decision to leave China for the United States? And two, what happened once they arrived? Listeners, you can join the discussion. I invite your questions and comments. The phone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Historian Iris Chang is the author of three books. Her previous books are The Rape of Nanking and Thread of the Silkworm. Iris Chang is a graduate of the University of Illinois. She earned an undergraduate degree in journalism in 1989. After leaving Champaign-Urbana, she worked briefly as a reporter in Chicago. She left Chicago after being awarded a graduate fellowship to the Writing Seminars Program at Johns Hopkins University. Her new book, The Chinese in America, A Narrative History, is published by Viking. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Iris Chang, greetings from Urbana.
Thank you very much.
Nice to talk with you this afternoon.
It's a privilege to be on the program.
You're a first-generation American. Your parents arrived in the U.S. from Taiwan, and earlier their parents, your grandparents, left China for Taiwan.
That's correct.
In terms of the two stories the Chinese in America tells, what have been the experiences of your parents and grandparents? Why did they leave Taiwan? Why did they leave China?
Well, we should probably start our story with the 1949 Communist Revolution. That's what pushed my family out of mainland China. My grandfathers were working for the nationalist government that was deposed by the communists during the Civil War. And so, like many other people of their generation, they fled to Taiwan. Actually, with my father's side of the family, it was a little more complicated than that. And then my parents spent their teen years and college years in Taiwan before migrating to the United States on doctoral scholarships to study at Harvard University. And actually, years later, they would come to Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, to work as professors here.
Yeah. Why did they decide to stay in the U.S.? Why did they leave Taiwan?
Well, there was no economic academic opportunities in Taiwan that could match what was available in the United States. In fact, my parents used to tell me that just about everyone of their generation wanted to come to the United States because that's where the best universities were and that's where the future was. For many, Taiwan was just a temporary resting ground after the Communist Revolution.
Yeah. The experiences of Chinese in America, how do they echo the experiences of the other immigrant groups?
Well, I would say that like other ethnic groups, the Chinese, when they first came here, had to deal with prejudice, often racial discrimination, and a lot of them started at the bottom of society working at menial jobs. That was especially the case for the first wave of Chinese immigration that came in the mid-19th century.
And how do they differ from the experiences of other groups?
Well, I would say that perhaps the main difference is that the Chinese actually lost about a century of political mobilization as a result of the exclusion laws.
Mm.
In 1882, as I describe in my book, The Chinese in America, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which shut from the gates of immigration Chinese laborers from coming to this country. Now, certain groups of Chinese immigrants were exempt, such as Chinese diplomats, scholars, and merchants. But for people who were engaged in physical labor, they could not come. And so while other ethnic groups were permitted to come to this country in large numbers and build up their political machines throughout the late 19th century, and also the 20th century, the Chinese laborers who did come often did so illegally as paper sons. And it was a very small population. In fact, at the early 20th century, there were only about a few tens of thousands of Chinese in this country, mostly men, because many of the people who came were husbands who would send money back to their families in China. And so there was even a time in our history where people were afraid that the Chinese population would simply die out. Now, of course, the situation would change after the exclusion laws were officially repealed in the 1940s, thanks to the Sino-American Wartime Alliance during World War II. And then in the 1960s, new legislation passed under Lyndon Johnson would sweep away the racist quotas that were imposed on Asian countries. And so it was not until just the last few decades that large-scale immigration from Asia and from China was really permitted in this country.
Yeah. Also, another big difference that you write about in the book, and that comes through throughout, that Chinese Americans have had great difficulty truly getting past the distinction of what you call of race, or quote entirely shaking the perception of being seen as foreigners in their own land.
And I think, again, that's tied into demographics, because suppose if we were to go back in time and if somehow the Chinese exclusion law was not passed, if large-scale immigration had from China continued, then demographically this country would have been different. That racially, many more people could have been Chinese, and therefore what would be seen as foreign might not necessarily be considered Chinese.
Mm.
So I think that, you know, the fact that they really were not permitted to come for so many decades would then help, make the Chinese a minority in this country, to the degree now where even at 3 million, which is the largest populations they've had in this country, that's only about 1% of the American population.
Yeah, this perception of being seen as foreigners, The final chapter of the book, you include some examples of this, and I was blown away by that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe you would share a few examples of this. I find it astounding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For example, there was a man who serving in the U.S. Air Force at a military awards banquet, and a woman says to him, "Are you in the Chinese Air Force?"
I know, and he's wearing
the blue,
the Air Force blue,
yeah.
Right, and the uniform. And that's how deeply ingrained often these perceptions were. I'm sure the question was not asked in a malevolent way.
No.
In fact, I mean, it's something that many Chinese Americans encounter every day. In fact, I've been on a major book tour in the last few weeks, and when I was in Philadelphia, while staying at the hotel, the housekeeper came through and said, "You speak really good English." And I said, she's for a Chinese, and I said, "Well, I was born here, and I'm a U.S. citizen." She articulated, she says, "But your English is still so good." I just really sense that once these images are imprinted on the American psyche, it's often hard to remove them. But But again, I think that it's a combination of many factors. One, that there are still relatively very few Chinese in this country. And secondly, the images that have been put forth by Hollywood and television have not been positive, and that's the problem that persists this very day.
Yeah. Well, maybe you would talk with us a little bit about the role that books, movies, and television have played in this regard.
Yes, absolutely. Well, many of the images of the Chinese on television and film, especially during the early part of the 20th century, were extremely negative. I mean, the Fu Manchu and Charlie Chan images, for example, during the early few decades of the 20th century, really depicted the Chinese as either mysterious or people who were very cunning and treacherous. And there was a female equivalent to these stereotypes as well, like the China Doll and the Dragon Lady stereotypes, which either presented the women as being very passive and sexually available to white men, or women who were who were treacherous and cunning and evil. And it's unfortunate even to this day where we see images in Hollywood movies that don't really get past the stereotypes of the Chinese as being like kung fu masters or ninjas exotic bar girls.
Also today we have the stereotype of the model minority. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's a stereotype that came into being, especially during the 1960s, especially as more Chinese Americans and Asian Americans began to enter, our most prestigious universities and also enter the professions, and it's an image that many Chinese Americans are not entirely comfortable with because. It applies the while they are model minorities, they're not exactly leaders, but are docile teachers' pets, and some people would also point out that it is not really an accurate depiction of the community because it hides the fact that there are many Chinese who are actually struggling and who are not really. Who are invisible in our society as illegal aliens, and they don't fit the model minority image either.
Yeah. One aspect of this history many of us might find surprising, I did, the history of activism mm-hmm. that's present in the story.
Yes, I was actually surprised to find the degree to which some of the early Chinese in this country were assertive in demanding their rights, and they used the law, and they were very litigious people, much to my astonishment. They didn't hesitate, for example, to sue their employers if they felt they were being treated badly. In fact, there was once, there had been efforts by Southern plantation workers, Southern plantation owners after the Civil War to replace black labor with Chinese labor. And what they didn't realize was that the Chinese tended to hire bilingual interpreters to negotiate their contracts, and then they would take their employers to court if they violated them. And they also sued white schools if they didn't admit their children. They on occasion would organize strikes if they felt they were being mistreated. In fact, one of the largest labor strikes in history was when the Chinese, when they held the strike during the building of the Transcontinental Railroad to protest the whippings they endured and the dangerous jobs they were shunted into. Some of their activism really laid down the foundation for civil rights law. For example, one of the most famous lawsuits, I would say, was Wong Kim Ark versus U.S., which firmly protected our right to birthright citizenship. And it's a very important ruling because it means that all Americans, all people who are born in the United States, are U.S. citizens and entitled to the full benefits of U.S. citizenship. Now, it's not necessarily the case in other countries. For example, in the nation of Japan, there are people who have been born on Japanese soil for generations, such as ethnic Korean families, but they are not considered Japanese citizens. And so without the concept of birthright citizenship, you run the risk of creating a permanent underclass that is deemed foreign, even if they have lived in that country for generations.
Also, on this topic of activism, I was interested to read about the response of Chinese Americans to the incursions of Japan into China in the 1930s. Talk with us about that part of this history.
Well, during Japan's invasion of China, which predated what many people consider to be the start of World War II, for many Chinese, World War II began as early as the early 1930s when Japan launched an undeclared war against China. And it was a conflict that would ultimately claim about 35 million Chinese lives. And Chinese Americans in this country would demonstrate they would try to publicize these atrocities. They held major rallies, and they also prevented, often through picket lines, the shipping of scrap metal mm-hmm. to Japan. And thanks to their activism, there eventually many other groups, non-Chinese groups, joined in the effort and eventually led to Roosevelt's decision to place an embargo on war material to Japan, which was one of the factors why Japan launched its attack on Pearl Harbor. So the role of these Chinese Americans in stopping these shipments, I think, played a very pivotal part of World War II history.
Yeah.
Also, the degree to which they helped the U.S. war effort, both in Asia and in Europe, is an important story, which I don't think many people are aware of. Now, in my book, The Chinese in America, I describe how fully 20%, one in five Chinese Americans in the continental U.S. served in the armed forces during World War II. I believe that was the highest, I think, percentage for any ethnic group at the time. And that's largely because the Chinese in this country were male, without dependents in the U.S. Many of them had families, though, back in China and sent many home. But that made them more vulnerable to the draft.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think it's important to note here that for China, the Second World War began in 1931.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That was, and the world did nothing.
That's right, and what is stunning is that, that many of these atrocities that were committed by Japan in China to this day are not very well known outside of Asia. And, in fact, that's the subject of my second book, The Rape of Nanking, The Forgotten Holocaust of World War II. It describes the fact that the Japanese Imperial Army murdered hundreds of thousands of Chinese civilians in the capital of China in 1937, which was then the city of Nanking. That's just one very small fraction of the war crimes that were committed across China and across Asia.
Mm.
For example, the whole story of the comfort women system, the system of sexual slavery, military slavery. Under the Japanese, from which I think only one in four women would survive, is only now starting to really come to light. Most of these women were Korean, although there were also victims who were Chinese and of other Asian ethnicities. There were the military and medical atrocities committed by Japanese doctors in secret medical labs like Unit 731 in Manchuria, where there were, you know, dissections without anesthesia and torturous experiments in which they would expose people to plague germs or freeze them alive. And what's very upsetting to me is that the United States government exonerated these Japanese doctors who committed these medical atrocities in exchange for their medical data, and then the real details of some of these secret negotiations are still classified by our government.
Mm-hmm. Growing up, were you interested in Chinese history and in Chinese American history?
I was, but I was. I remember being deeply offended by many of the anti-Chinese stereotypes in popular culture, and that was definitely something that I felt should be rectified with books that would depict the history of my people in an honest manner, either as novels or as nonfiction books.
Mm. There's a woman in the Chinese in America who I find very interesting, and I would like to go and look for her work. Her name is Edith Maud Eaton.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the people in this history, I wonder if she is one you find particularly fascinating.
She's interesting because she gives voice to the mixed race experience in this country. Her pseudonym was Sui Sin Far. And I think only recently too have her works been scrutinized by scholars and really given the attention that she deserves it. And she wrote essays often and short stories about the Chinese American experience. And there's been some talk between. Some of the editors I know who perhaps publishing her work in the future.
Mm.
But many of her early stories were often published in whatever mediums she could get her hands on. Sometimes small newspapers publications of very limited distribution.
Yeah. Can you give us a sense of the feeling with which she wrote, because when I read this part of the story, I thought, here we have this being a foreigner in your own land, and also maybe even being a foreigner in your own skin.
Right, exactly. In fact, she has. She wrote a paragraph that I found especially compelling. I'm going to find this in my book, in which she felt that her mother's legacy was just being denied her, and she didn't understand why it was that there was that kind of deep discrimination against that side of her family,
I think it's at page 115, 114.
115, 114. Okay, I have it right here. And she says, I come from a race on my mother's side which is said to be the most stolid and insensible to feelings of all races, and yet I look back over the years and see myself so keenly alive to every shade of sorrow and suffering that it is almost a pain to live. Mother tells us tales of China. Though as a child, when she left her native land, she remembers it well, and I am never tired of listening to the story of how she was stolen from her home. She tells us over and over again of her meeting with my father in Shanghai and the romance of their marriage. I glory in the idea of dying at the stake and a great genie arising from the flames and declaring to those who have scorned us, behold, how great and glorious and noble are the Chinese people. Whenever I have the opportunity, I steal away to the library and read every book I can find on China and Chinese. I learned that China is the oldest civilized nation on the face of the earth, and a few other things. At 18 years of age, what troubles me is not that I am what I am, but that others are ignorant of my superiority. And then she also asks the question in her autobiographical Leaves from the Mental Portfolio of a Eurasian, Why is my mother's race despised? I look into the faces of my mother and father. Is she not every bit as dear and as good as he? Why? Why? So she was one of the first to document the sense of pride and yet confusion of being somebody who was half Chinese, half Caucasian.
Yeah. And that sense that we get there of the precarious status of her identity in America, that is something that begins with the beginning of this story, the Chinese in America, and continues today.
Mm-hmm. And what I find, too, so intriguing is that I think the Chinese-American experience also encompasses those of the descendants of some of the early Chinese, many of whom are not even recognizably Chinese, but many of whom still have retained some sense of their Chinese culture. And near the end of my book, as you know, I describe people who are part Chinese and part African American or part Caucasian, and really show how they have pretty much viewed their identity, and it really in the end becomes a very individual and personal decision.
Mm-hmm. Iris Chang is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about her new book, The Chinese in America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you're invited to join the discussion. Your questions and comments are invited. The telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Iris Chang is the author of three books. Her previous books are The Rape of Nanking and Thread of the Silkworm. Let's talk with a listener now who is waiting for us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yeah, am I on?
You're on.
Oh, hi. I have a question about media images and Asian Americans. I've noticed that, you know, they become more successful, like people like Lucy Liu, you know, she's really broken to the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, I'm happy to see that, but on the other hand, it seems to be only because they can play stereotypical roles, you know, the Dragon Lady or the Kung Fu Master, as you mentioned earlier. I think the recent James Bond movie, you know, the villain that we had with it was Asian American as well. I was wondering if you can comment on that, you know, whether it's better for actors and actresses in that position not to take those kind of roles or to go ahead and take them and hopefully open up possibilities for more meaningful roles in the future.
I think it's going to be hard to tell actors not to take certain roles just because it is so difficult to mm-hmm. be an actor these days, and so there's always going to be somebody who will jump for these roles. And, you know, it is very unfortunate to see how these stereotypes like that of the Dragon Lady you know, reinvented for the modern age. You know, the Dragon Lady stereotype in the Ally, you know, McNeil programs. I mean, it was updated, but it was still very much, it was still very much the same old stereotype. And I think that things are not going to change until more Chinese Americans or Asian Americans enter the film industry, and not only as writers and actors, but as executives in the studios, and finally, maybe through the creation of their own studios or the ownership of studios, because it's not just the artistic side of the business that needs change, but also
the commercial.
Yes, and the distribution channels, mm-hmm. which is important.
Is that happening? Are there more Asian production companies? And I know there's.
I see more people entering the field, mm-hmm. and more discussions on the subject. So I think that the representation was very limited, mainly because of the demographic realities. There were so few Asian Americans in this country. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until recently that we started seeing big waves of Chinese Americans, you know, Chinese coming into this country, but they tended to be drawn into this country by, like, science and technology.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's where the money was. A lot of it had to do with the fact that, you know, during the Cold War, the government poured billions of dollars into research and development, and the the people who came did not often have the kinds of English language skills that would be required often to succeed in film. But their children are entering the profession, but they're still relatively young.
Right.
I have many friends who, you know, are in Hollywood who are, whether they are struggling actors or movie stars, that the Asian American actors and actresses I know complain of getting, you know, scripts that, you know, that really shunt them into ninja roles or, you know, the massage girl part, massage girl roles, and so I think what they really would have to do probably is to raise some of their own money and actually and to finance some of the productions themselves.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. This afternoon, other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's go back now to, if we can, we've been talking about contemporary matters and the 20th century. Maybe we could go back now to the time of the first wave of immigration to the U.S., the mid-19th century.
Right.
What was happening in China?
In the mid-19th century?
Yes, mid-19th century.
It was a tumultuous time in China. It was the Qing Dynasty was suffering from not only financial difficulties, but just the weight of its own political corruption. And it was a time that forced literally millions of Chinese out of the country to flee the floods and the famines that ravaged the countryside to flee banditry. And most of all, I would say, just the lack of financial opportunities there. So some Chinese went to the United States to join the gold rush, but there were others who spread across the globe in search of opportunity.
Now, what would people have known about the outside world at this time? What would people living in China have known about the United States
or
Europe?
Very little.
Or,
there was a lot more exposure to Western culture along the coasts of China, but even there, sometimes all they knew about the United States was it was filled with these red-haired, green-eyed barbarians. And I found myself greatly amused by some of the early reports that were sent back to China by the people who came. There were reports, obviously, written up by some of the diplomats, and they would comment on how the women of this barbarian country would walk around without bound feet, and they were just shocked that they would be using metal utensils to eat instead of chopsticks. The men of status would wear these long flowing satin robes, and so they were very surprised to see men, wearing what they call tight jackets and tight trousers. And I remember seeing in one report, they're saying, how could these men even move? and they were just baffled often by the custom of kissing, which I don't think was very well known in China. They were trying to describe it in popular magazines, saying that it was almost like that of a fish, fish sound or of a chirp, but it wasn't quite right.
yeah. And at the same time, Westerners were seeing the Chinese also as curiosities, as strange creatures.
In fact, yes, the first documented Chinese woman in the United States was displayed as part of a museum exhibit in New York City. So they were such oddities because of their limited numbers that some of them worked as circus performers. I would say that before the mid-19th century, there were probably as few as only about 50 ethnic Chinese people in the whole country.
Yeah. And among these, Chang and Eng Bunker.
Mm-hmm. Now, I find them interesting because it just goes to show, I think, that a lot of the racism that the Chinese experienced was tied into factors beyond that of simple, you know, skin color and physical differences. Because Chang and Ang Bunker, for the benefit of your listeners who don't know who they were the famous Siamese twins who were who shared a liver and were connected by their torsos through this 5-inch ligament of flesh, and they actually were ethnically Chinese, and they toured the whole world as celebrities before settling down in Wilkesboro, North Carolina, where they were so, I guess, deeply welcomed and embraced by a lot of the townspeople, they decided to stay, and they married white women, and they had 21 children between them, and they also started their own plantation and had 33 black slaves. Now, it's interesting that they really were, you know, accepted as part of the plantation landowning elite. I think it was because there were so few Chinese people in that region that they weren't really seen as an economic threat. But they were really so well accepted that their two eldest sons actually enlisted in the Confederate Army, you know, during the Civil War when they came of age. But in regions like California, where there are many more Chinese, ironically, it was in those places that they experienced the worst discrimination, because they were really seen as a major threat to white workers who desperately needed jobs. And Chinese capitalists and Chinese wage earners were extremely efficient in places like San Francisco. And during an economic depression in the 1870s, the Chinese experienced a huge backlash because they posed a formidable economic threat to white people at the time.
And there was a judge in California who said that Chinese were Indians. And
that's right.
This ruling.
Tell us about this, to prevent them from testifying against white people. Indians and blacks were not allowed to testify against whites, and this one judge tried to make the argument that just because Christopher Columbus was confused and couldn't tell the difference between Chinese and Indians, that they should be considered one and the same. And because of that ruling, the Chinese were not permitted to testify against whites. And that opened up, you know, all kinds of, you know, assaults on their life and property, because often the complaining witnesses, victims are often the only witnesses to these crimes.
Yeah. Well, at this time, could Chinese immigrants become citizens?
Actually, they also lost the right to naturalization
because
of these anti-Chinese laws.
Yeah. And then
they almost lost their right to birthright citizenship, too. But fortunately, a Wong Kim Ark versus U.S. protected that right, that even if the parents were not eligible for citizenship, their children born on U.S. soil would be. And that's why it's such an important ruling.
Yeah. In the book, you write Gold Mountain Dreams. These were the people that came from China in search of gold. You write, Gold Mountain dreams came true for a few, but many more Chinese immigrants found only heartbreak, failure, and loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
Here, this strikes me as part of the American immigrant experience, because I imagine that was the case for most of the people who rushed to California.
Yes. And actually, it wasn't just often the Chinese who were scapegoated. In fact, in the early days of the Gold Rush, the Australians were often seen as potential criminals, and they often were really targeted for assault as well. So, I would like readers to see this story as not just as a foreign or ethnic one, but really as a part and parcel of the American experience.
Yeah.
And, there are many parallels we can draw between the Chinese experience and that of other immigrant groups.
Yeah, well, it resonates with me as a descendant of Irish immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so.
Yeah, and what was intriguing to me was that that when the Irish first came to this country, they suffered tremendous prejudice. I mean, even though they were white, and there would be signs up in businesses, "No Irish need apply." And then later, during the during the years that led up to the exclusion era, many Irish Americans would often protest, and they would try to drive the Chinese out. And so it was really interesting to see the relationship between the Chinese and the Irish immigrant groups. And another thing that astonished me was that at one time, Chinese-Irish interracial marriage was far more common than I would have expected. That because of the shortage Chinese women and Irish men in those populations, that Chinese men often married Irish women in cities like New York in fairly large numbers.
Yeah. We mentioned Cheng and Eng Bunker, but before the exclusion era, how common was assimilation? How did that look?
I think it really would depend on the region that they lived in. I would say that if we were to talk just simply of interracial marriages, that they were fairly common for the Chinese in regions like the South or even or the East Coast, and it was actually far less common, I think, in areas like California, where there were much larger numbers of Chinese. The worst laws, anti-Chinese laws, were passed in California, actually, and that's why many of them found themselves marginalized and ghettoized, in that state.
In Chinatowns.
Mm-hmm.
This was an interesting part of the story as well. So much. This is a good read, Iris.
Thank you.
How it was that Chinatown became an attraction for visitors in San Francisco. It was an effort at rebuilding. It was an effort at economic development following the San Francisco earthquake.
And for
better or for worse.
That's right. What I find so intriguing about the story was how tourism in Chinatown became popular. And the Chinese, initially they lived in Chinatowns because of the anti-Chinese laws that really prevented them from living in white neighborhoods. But after Chinatowns emerged, Chinese merchants would look for ways to bring revenue into their neighborhoods. And one such method was to actually make the neighborhoods a lot more titillating than they really were to white sightseers, and hence the many of the anti-Chinese stereotypes that we have are not just a result of white racism, but the exploitation or prostitution of these Chinese images by Chinese merchants.
Very interesting. Also, this was interesting to learn that in America, the merchant class is held in esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Not so in China.
Yes.
Or at least some time ago.
That's right. I mean, Chinese society respected the scholar or the official, but not necessarily. But the merchant was considered near the bottom of society. But in the United States, where capitalism, of course, is revered, then Chinese merchants had much higher status. And what we find in a lot of these Chinatowns was immediate class differences between the Chinese workers and the Chinese capitalists. And there was soon in San Francisco an elite of Chinese factory owners and storekeepers who became the leaders or the people who controlled those regions.
Yeah, very interesting. We have to wrap up here. We're out of time. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
I would like to add one thing.
Sure.
Do your airways reach St. Louis or actually Minneapolis, because I could mention some of the places where I'll be signing.
Why don't you give a quick mention? People listening on the web might be able to take advantage of your appearances there, but our AM signal doesn't hit St. Louis, nor does it hit Minnesota. But
this evening I'll be signing at Carleton College at their bookstore at 7 p.m., and then tomorrow I'll be in St. Louis signing at Left Bank Books, which is 399 North Euclid in St. Louis at 7 p.m. But I just didn't know if your airwaves reached that far.
Yeah. Iris, again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Iris Chang, the author of The Chinese in America. The book is published by Viking.